Welcome everyone to this edition of Happy ME Lunch. And today we're going to be talking about student mental health, which is a crisis the world over. Unfortunately, my guest today, Nargish Kambhata, is down with her. She's ill. So we're having to improvise without her. But we do have an illustrious panel of guests from around the world who have a lot of experience in this space. And so we're going to run this event slightly differently. And I'm going to invite all of you to comment as we travel. Please add your comments in the chat and then just raise your hand if you'd like to speak. Otherwise, I'll be reaching out to you as we talk for your comments. For example, I'm joined by Anika, who's a student counselor in Dubai, Janie, who runs Teenagers Translated and has been working with teenagers for a long time, Samira, who is a teenager on our program and has worked extensively with me, and Gopalan, who's one of our coaches from Singapore, and so on. So there's a lot of really experienced people here. And David is a dean of students at the American University of Law in Washington. So many wonderful perspectives. So let's start with why. Why are we bothering with this question? Well, there's a real crisis in education. So at the moment, the American College Health Association, the ACHA, did a survey of 54,000 students and found 77% suffer from stress, 35% from anxiety, 27% of them are depressed. The CDC, which is a real source of good data in America, says 17% of young people are self-harming and 57% of girls feels persistently sad. The WHO says one in seven teens has a mental health condition, which is one in five in the UK, and one in five young people say they're bullied. The charity Mind says 96% of young people say mental health impacts learning. So that's a great sort of wake-up call to us all. David, can I ask you whether these numbers are reflected in your experience in Washington at the College of Law?
Yeah, the numbers reflect that significantly. I had the privilege of co-piloting two national surveys of law student well-being, one in 2014 and one in 2021. And the numbers around depression and anxiety would certainly track that. And we added factors of binge drinking, substance use of prescription drugs and things of that nature. And we're picking up all of the, it's the law student level, obviously. In the United States, you're talking 21 to 24 years old, but we're picking up all the tail end of all the kids you're referencing in the other surveys.
Yes. And of course, all this is vital because education is a place of learning and all this impacts learning. So when I did a survey of young people, I said, does this impact, 80% of them said stress impacts learning. But more interestingly, half the staff are stressed and they say stress impacts my ability to teach as well. So we're going to explore this subject in two ways. Firstly, we're going to explore what can we do to change the environment these kids are growing up in, so to make that environment less stressful. And the second way we're going to explore this question is how can we empower them with the tools to meet those challenges in a way where they can cope better, more resilient, be less stressed. And as part of that, I'm going to show you around the resources that we've developed around the Happier Me app. Anika, what's your thought on how much of a problem this is in teenagers in schools?
Well, I think like when Mr. Jose had come in and kind of shared the conversation he had this morning around social media and a lot of social comparison that tends to happen as a result of the, you could almost say, the ease of access of information. Mental health related conversations and issues are definitely seem to be on the rise amongst teenagers. It could be seen as almost like a double-edged sword if you come to think of it. If you were to talk about feeling like low and stressed and anxious, and if you're kind of sharing it with someone who's of maybe just the previous generation or just a few years back, they hit teenage, they'd be like, yeah, but I went through it as well. I think I managed just fine. It would then kind of come down to probably the current generation, the teenagers being more equipped with a lot more awareness being, put out there, a lot more conversations around mental health, depression and anxiety, there's a lot more vocabulary that is available to students and teenagers now. So it's almost like a double-edged sword. With the awareness and education, one, they're able to maybe correctly identify what is going on because of all the stress and challenges that they are facing. But then it also makes you wonder at some point, is this awareness to some extent even becoming a crutch? Are they able to kind of look past it and be like, okay, this is something that I am struggling with, therefore, what can I do about it? Or is it like, oh, because I've identified it, let me just kind of, just let that pot just kind of boil and let me just kind of sit around with it. So yes, Manoj, it is definitely the rise, because when we look at it from the counseling perspective in school settings, we do see, a gentle rise in depression, anxiety, and, related things, and a lot more of like small groups, small pockets of it emerging as well. So it is a concern. And of course, I mean, this webinar, I think, will be really powerful in terms of identifying what could be those seeds.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Joe Skipper is a psychologist based in New York, but he's also worked in the New York school system for a long time. Correct me if I've got that slightly wrong, Joe, but I'd love your thoughts on the extent of the problem that you've seen in education in terms of mental health.
Yeah, so I would say it's enormous here. But I work in a very I work in about 30 minutes outside of Manhattan in a suburb that is very high pressured. So my experience, even though I've had experience with rural schools as well as urban schools, right now I'm pretty much centered in a suburban area of high socioeconomic status folks. So these are kids who are coming from homes that where the expectations are high, and therefore the schools are driving. Well, I can't even say that the schools are driving this. I would have to say that it's the state and the federal government that are driving the standards that are putting these kids behind the eight ball. What I've seen since COVID, and I spent, yeah, you're right, a lot of years in public education, 39 to be exact, and as a teacher, as a psychologist, and ending my last 6 years as an administrator, as a district level administrator, dealing with my department dealt with all of the special programs. And so I supervise psychologists, counselors, special education, all the providers, all the clinicians. And what I noticed, and I retired in 2021 from that position. So it was right as we were coming out of, we were fully opened at that point from the pandemic. But I saw what was coming. The level of stress by parents about what their kids had missed. The fact that kids had been for quite some time, at least the last half of the school year in 2020, been doing online instruction, which was something that we pivoted to within 24 hours. So we were really unprepared for that. I think we did an admirable job, but it wasn't perfect. And so there were lots of issues with it. What I've seen now after I've been out of it and in private practice, and I do see a lot of kids as well as adults, and I work with various school districts because of my background. What I'm noticing is that kids, I would say, to the point about social media, yes, absolutely, social media is an enormous influencer on these kids, and that's a place of where they compare themselves. But there's also this worry about the future. You know, the world is in a very different place for them than it was just 4 or 5 years ago. And so they are struggling with that. Some of the college students that I see law students as well from really wonderful law schools around here, who are also really very anxious, very, very concerned about what the future looks like for them. Now with the advent of AI coming out and everybody kind of scrambling about what's this going to look like, and do I follow my passions or do I follow something that's just going to get me a job and then be depressed for the rest of my life? So there's a lot of things on the table here.
A lot of things on the table. Joe, thank you for that. So let's talk about pressure. Samaira is a teenager in New Delhi. And Samaira, the pressure comes both from parents, from school and society. How do teenagers cope with that? Where do you think the maximum pressure comes from?
There are a lot of ways of pressure, actually. So, I mean, a lot of people define pressure differently. I'd say I have pressure, hypothetically speaking, I have pressure of scoring well in my 12th board. A lot of people have pressure well in performing in some extracurricular activities. And especially being from India and comparing myself to, I don't know if a lot of teenagers here would agree with me, but teenagers outside of India, you know, we do face this difference in pressure coming from teachers and our education system and our parents, of course. So in India, I'll say that a lot of people, a lot of students face pressure from the school and from their parents to score well. And I think that's one of the major, you know, kind of points that the pressure comes on us, and of scoring well, because this education system is so twisted in India. And I'd use this word twisted, because in India, there's this common saying that if you don't score well, you don't get a good college, and that's the end of your life, without understanding that there's a lot more to life.
Absolutely, Samaira. So all the research from the 1950s has shown that the correlation between grades in school and college and success in the world is around 20-25%. The rest of it has come always from emotional intelligence, your communication, relationship skills, all of that, your resilience and so on. So for example, my son, who's 26, has got a job now, though he's been to good colleges and got good degrees, but he was hired because he can talk well, because he's got a sales job and they think, oh yeah, you'll be able to talk to your customers well. But it's not something they teach you in school or college anywhere. So Janie, what's your experience with the teenagers here in England? Janie's worked a lot with them here in terms of the pressures they face from the outside.
Sorry, just get myself off mute. Yes, similar to the other speakers. Yes, of course, they are facing pressures from the outside, both from social media and from parents and from schools in order to do well. But I think also they face pressures from the inside, from themselves. Yes. And I think that, you know, the work that I do with young people, and this is sort of within the classroom, part of their PSHE and their RS relationship and sex education, part of that is to build a self-awareness and understanding of themselves, what causes them to feel that sort of pressure and therefore stress, what does that really feel like in their body, what do they need to do about it? So in terms of thinking, you know, I'm helping them to start to think about coping strategies, so healthy coping strategies and unhealthy coping strategies. And obviously the unhealthy coping strategies end up, as in your first contributor, sorry, I don't have anybody's names up on my screen, I'm really sorry, that you know, that will manifest itself in drug use, you know, the use of all substances, alcohol, you know, food issues, self-harming, and obviously the worst thing is suicide. So those are the unhealthy coping strategies. But what I'm trying to teach much younger children is about sleep and, you know, all the much, much more kind of practical things, but also having a more kind of positive head on their shoulders, because there's something about this lack of resilience that is going on, this lack of being able to sort of bounce back, because the world feels so big to them with all the environmental issues that have been mentioned, that actually children, you know, and young people, where they can sort of come back to, well, what can I do to cope and manage better with myself? And to just shrink it down to today's problems, this task, and sort of build the muscle of resilience so you can start to manage and cope and start to feel good about yourself, just in a very kind of step-by-step way.
Thank you, Janie. So that actually leads me really perfectly into really the main subject of our event today, which is, how can we equip people with the awareness tools to manage all the challenges they face, because we can't take away all their challenges. Society just can't do that. And the main thing to realize, I think, the work we've been doing with Happier Me is that the mind is an automatic reaction machine. And these reactions come from the content of all our conditioning and from various patterns of thinking that are built into the way our mind works. Gopalan, do you want to get the ball rolling on that? Gopalan is a coach based in Singapore who's been doing a lot of work with self-awareness.
Thank you, Manoj. Most of the focus I sense that's going on is to how students can cope with the stress that cannot be controlled because it's external, right? And what you see as stress or whatever negativity may not be the same for each individual. It varies with individuals. But why is that so?
Yes.
Why is that so? Why is it that one child or teenager seem to be able to cope better and has better defenses or has better methodology? Is it because of the support he's getting from people around him or her? Is it because they grew up in a family, supportive family, with values supporting that child through whatever they go through?
Yes, yes. So the key thing, so what we are trying to do with teenagers, and I'm sure Samara will come in at some point, is to help them understand why their mind is reacting in the way that it is to automatically to those challenges. Because all the mental health emotional distress we feel in ourselves is an automatic reaction to the world. And as you said, Gopalan, some people react to the same situation with calm and the other someone else, you know, will commit suicide. And why is that? So we just have a three-step process of inquiry. It's all based on inquiry. One is to be aware of what's happening. So, yep, there's an exam. I'm going for an exam. Second is to be aware of how you're feeling about it. So I'm really stressed. And the third question, which opens the door to wisdom or emotional intelligence, is to ask, what's going on in my mind that I'm not aware of that's making me feel this way? So in the case of an exam, it might be, I'm worried about failure, for example. And to question that, how likely is it that I'm going to fail? Or in Samira's case, I'm not going to get the result that I want. Does it matter if I don't get those grades? Can I still succeed in the world? And of course you can, and so on. So there are some common patterns of thinking that are common to all human beings that we're not aware of, that shape our mental health. And the first one is comparison. Our mind is comparing all the time. We're not aware that we're doing so. And so if we're on, and social media has really magnified this, because when I was growing up, we compared ourselves with the 20 kids in our class, but now there's a million people on Instagram or TikTok or whatever it might be. So someone is always going to be better than us. And that, without our awareness, creates a reaction in our thinking that I'm not good enough, or I've not got enough likes, and so on. And that process of comparison is what's driving a lot of mental distress. Samira, do you want to speak on that as a teenager dealing with social media and comparison?
It, like you said, is a very big thing, social media. And like you said rightly, you were comparing yourself with 20 kids, and we have this entire world to tackle ourselves with, even if, you know, we're not connecting with that person, but we can see that they're doing better than us, not just in grades, but also as life conditions or life situations. I'll take a very simple example. Let's say I would want to go to a place and travel and, you know, go to that place for a vacation. And I see somebody else doing that. That'll kind of spark this jealousy in me that, oh, why is this person getting to do this before me? So something like this, a lot of situations and a lot of scenarios arise. And in terms of marks and coping up with stress and academic failure, it does happen through social media, yes. My way of tackling it is I'd always take the worst case scenario, which I think is a human tendency. And I'd ask myself, how will I tackle that possible thing? Let's say I fail an exam. I'm stressing about it. So I'll fail the exam. What next? What will be my next step? The world's not going to end there. Something like that. Okay. And like all the amazing speakers are telling here that they are trying to teach people how to cope up with it positively. I think that's missing in the schools here in India. And that's one of the very big steps that we need to take. Of course, teaching us how to cope up with it. Of course, the teachers need to be very patient with us and try to understand that this is not just a problem of, you know, self-image, but a problem also created by people who are around us. And we are just mere teenagers. We have a lot in the world to see. We have a lot of years ahead of us. So I think teachers and educators should definitely understand and help us in this.
Samaira, thank you for that. Because what teachers and parents are inadvertently doing is comparing children with others. And that process of comparison is actually causing a lot of the emotional distress that young people feel. Joe, go ahead.
So I wanted to dovetail on what Samaira was saying, and I want to compliment you on your ability to really problem solve and articulate that. I think that you're an example of what is often lacking in what our teenagers today, and even our younger kids, have the opportunity to do. You have the language that you can put around this. And a lot of kids don't have the language that they can put around it. They are not doing the problem solving, looking critically, thinking critically about this and seeing what impacts them. So then they lack the skill level sometimes to actually engage in a problem solving process to reduce their stress.
Yes. And you know, kids are incredibly smart. And so one of my passions is that this self-understanding should become part of education. Let me share with you a tiny story. I was talking to some kids who were about 13 or 14 in a school. We're talking about comparison and how it makes them feel and all the things we know, low self-esteem, etc. And we also came to the point where they understood it happens automatically without their awareness. So I asked a simple question. I said, how would your life change if your mind only compared itself with others when it served you and not automatically like it's doing now? And a girl at the back of the class who'd said nothing all during the session said, I would be free. So just by becoming aware of what's happening in our own mind allows us to have choices in terms of how we deal with that. And this is something that's completely missing in education. When I talk to 10-year-old kids and I say, you're friend next to you gets more marks in maths than you, how do you respond? And these kids are beautiful. And they say, well, I don't like my friend because they've got more marks than me. So I stop talking to my friend. I don't like myself because I think I'm no good at maths anymore. But I also stop liking the subject because I associate that subject with this bad feeling in myself. And this is something educators are just not aware of. And comparison is built into education, all the way from top to bottom. And this is something that perhaps education needs to reflect on and understand better. Janie, do you want to add anything to that?
Yes, I was just going to add, but I've read a very recent report about transforming educational culture. And what this report had done is it had listened to a lot of young people. And sort of back to what Samaira was saying, I mean, the what came out from a lot of the young people was that they needed a lot more time spent in discussion, in facilitated discussion groups around their learning. I mean, this was more particularly around sort of the PSHE type subjects, relationship subjects, etc., but also mental health and well-being. And I think when everyone lives in an isolated place online and you're just searching for your online kind of solutions, that is leading young people down rabbit holes. But whereas if young people can be brought together to have a lot more time to discuss what are we finding difficult, having time to talk about the things like relationships and communication and image and identity and toxic cultures online and watching pornography or any sort of mental health issues, where they can have more time to talk about it, that can start to help them to build their image and identity, but within their own cohort, as opposed to this world forum of social media, which is, you know, just skewing everybody's kind of outlooks and, for me, causing quite a lot of, you know, the mental health issues. You know, our education system is very didactic. It isn't it doesn't have a facilitation style that enables young people of all ages at university as well to have more time sort of in discussion to use that whole concept of emotional contagion rather than catching the emotions from this online drama to actually sort of be more present. And of course, that will help them with, as you're talking about your 26-year-old son, Manoj, you know, to have better communication style when they go for interviews and go for jobs and be better able to relate to other people.
Thank you, Jenny. David, what do you think about this whole business of comparison in education? Because you're Dean of Students, and what do you think education institutions could do to address that in some way?
You know, it's interesting. I happen to work at a law school, and I've been here for a number of years, where we have actually taken pride in the fact that at our school, at this level, our students are actually, the competition they have is with themselves, but not with each other. It's actually in sharp contrast to a lot of law schools of which I'm aware around the US, not all of them. We have about 200 law schools in the country. And this has been a result of a number of years of work among our staff and our faculty to inculcate with the students from day one that this is going to be a supportive, dare say, non-competitive environment, that everybody wants to do well. And if you can all do well, you're going to. The students feel it. They feel the resources. They feel the, you know, the well-being programming we do from our office. They then find that they want to give that back as upper level students to the first year students and so on and so on. And they find the support in the staff and the faculty. So I don't have a great answer for that one, because I actually, in my small world, which is my law school where I work, setting aside the national presentations and other stuff I try to do, I try to say it starts from day one, and that you can actually be, you don't have to be competitive at the law school level with each other. It doesn't have to be cutthroat in order to get what you need to get. So,
I don't know
if that's a great answer in that regard.
No, such an enlightened law school. I wish all the institutions in the world were as enlightened. You see, behind competition is fear, right? The parents are afraid of their kids' future, so they want them to be better than everyone else. And of course, being better brings a certain amount of pleasure. So my kid is better than your kid. So, you know, that brings a certain pride and all that. So that's one thing that's driving competition. Fear is the other one. And the alternative, which I think you're talking about, David, is you can excel because you love the subject. So if instead of using fear to make people do well, we instead created a love for the subject or for the material to help them excel in their work, in the work they're doing, this could completely transform education and create a love for learning, which then can last all your life. Because at the moment, as soon as they finish the exams, kids just want to walk away from, because they associate learning and education with so much pressure and stress and all of that. Okay, but we're moving on. And the other big reason why kids get stressed is because of the need for external validation. And it's again an unconscious driver in our own thinking. When I ask kids, how much of your time do you spend thinking about what other people are thinking about you? And they say, almost all the time. And I said, how much of that contributes to your stress? And they say, it's huge. And it's an unconscious process in our thinking. And whether you ask a five-year-old or 18-year-old, I said, why does your mind do that? And they say, otherwise we'd be alone. I said, have you tried being alone? And they said, no, we haven't. So you're afraid of something you actually haven't tried yourself, but it's a fear. And it's again, an unconscious driver in our thinking. I said, do you like everybody you meet? They said, no, we don't. I said, then why should you expect everyone you meet to like you? Do you think it's a reasonable expectation? They say, no, it isn't. So once you start talking and opening this up with kids, and again, the unconscious in your own mind becomes conscious, then you start developing this greater sense of self. Anika, do you want to talk about that at all? This need for external validation and how it affects young people?
In fact, it's really interesting that you brought it up, Manoj. Like, if you actually look at it from a very theory-based understanding, and if you have to kind of refer to Jean Piaget's theory of cognitive development, if you look at the adolescent stage as proposed by Piaget, there is this whole concept of imaginary audience that he had put forward, where he was trying to express the fact that teenagers often tend to have a tendency to, or they have this belief that those around them are as concerned and focused on them as they are about themselves. So, and because of this concept of imaginary audience, they're constantly on the watch. So even if it's like a regular day and everything's going off well, in their mind, cognitively, they're constantly processing that someone is watching me. There's a spotlight on me. Therefore, what I do is magnified. And when you magnify something, and especially when you're going through the teenage time where there's already so many questions about yourself, and when there's a whole imaginary audience and imaginary spotlight on yourself, it really tends to make things a lot more stressful for the teenagers. And therefore, they're constantly on that lookout, that comparison, that looking over the shoulder. What's happening? Am I good enough? Am I doing the best that I can? Should I be doing better? And why did they look at me that way? They didn't smile at me the way they were supposed to. Why the person? So many questions. So yes,
I'm going to raise one more point, and I'm going to ask you all to comment on that. So the second linked or related point is the need to belong and to fit in. And it's really powerful. I've got a 16-year-old stepson at home, and that's his number one cause of stress. He doesn't feel he fits in. I said, why do you need to fit in? Why can't you just have the courage to be yourself? But these conversations are not happening in education. And these kids are just being thrown in at the deep end to deal with and face all this stuff. So there's a fear of being excluded, and you have to change yourself to fit into the group, and then you're worried about being excluded. And a lot of teenagers say they end up behaving badly to other people, other teenagers, because otherwise they're worried the group will exclude them, you know, and that's where bullying comes in and so on. Joe, do you want to speak on that, on those two points, the need for external validation and our need to fit in and belong? And how can we help teenagers get past both of those?
I wish I had a magic answer to that. When you look at developmental psychology, this is a time for kids that becoming part of a group is very important to them. As they transfer it from, you know, childhood even into this adolescent period, we have research that says that, you know, their peer groups really have more influence on them than their parents do, than their family does. And that says something about the way teenage minds work and their development. And so we can't ignore that. So I think that I think that that's one of the things that I try to point out is I give them that research and say, I know how important this is to you. And, you know, and I'm just an old guy trying to guide you. But that brings me to the next point, which is how do we establish mentors for our young people today? When I was growing up, in a difficult situation in my family. I was very fortunate that I had a number of mentors along my path to my career. Those people were very important to me. How do we create that? And I think that schools have to look at that too. How do we create connection and mentorship for kids so that we can move them into that place of resilience and that place of individuality that you can be, or as I say to them, you can be the same in some things that you feel connect with you and that will bring you part of your tribe. And then you need to also figure out where you stand as an individual so that you can stand apart up from and then be able to develop your own attitudes. And I think kids need a safe space to be able to talk about that and to be able to share, and the universality of even in the group to be able to discuss those things so that they know that they're not alone in this experience.
Yes, I think that's a big one, Dave, Joe, which is to feel every child feels what they're suffering is unique to them. And they're the only person suffering. And I think opening up these conversations in educational institutions where there's a subject which says, this is, we're talking about self-knowledge, understanding your own mind. Because the moment you become aware that your need to fit in and your need for external validation is actually causing all your suffering, and it's not serving you, then you can start examining that for yourself. Which leads me really to the next point, and I'd love Gopalan to come in on this, is conditioning, because it's a process by which all our past influences shape our thinking and our beliefs and our behavior, but we're not aware we're being conditioned. That's why you're Russian, I'm Ukrainian or American or whatever religion you belong to. We become attached to our conditioning, so our opinions, our beliefs, and then anyone we meet who's different to us is weird, is other than me. And when it comes to young people, they react to that in a really primal way without being the civilized sort of influences on them by bullying, excluding, teasing, and so on. Samaira, how do you feel as a young person about conditioning and how that impacts young people?
It's a very strong concept, like we were talking about external validation, be it marks or other people's comments, likes. This drive for getting external validation, I'd say we've made up a false reality, we as in the teenagers around us. And I'm not lying, me at some point, I'm just a teenager, me at some point, I had also made up this false made up reality of getting external validation from people's comments. So conditioning in that makes a lot of difference. I'd say the environment I've grown up in has made an impact. The support from my parents and the support from my, I'd say I'm a person, I can go out alone. I can spend time with myself. And that's very important. Like we were talking about how people need to be in groups, need to feel included. The point is we need to understand that our own company and our own validation for ourselves is should be, you know, kept at the highest point. That is where we start appreciating ourselves. And that's important. That's what I feel.
Thank you. Gopalan, do you want to talk about conditioning and how can we help young people be aware of their conditioning and then be able to question it? See? Because even as adults, we never question what we think or feel or how we behave. How do you think we could help people do that?
I think, as with a lot of things in terms of our journey, it starts at a very young age, even before we are aware of it, right?
Yes.
So basically, there must be awareness. It has to start with awareness. And if once you are aware that everybody is on the same operating system,
yes,
and that everything is working in the subconscious, then you realize that, you know, if I'm trying to figure out why is that person dealing with me in this manner and I'm reacting to it, then I got to find out why am I feeling that way in the first place?
Yes.
Because it's subconscious, you know, the only thing you know is you are not feeling good about it. And we need to start asking.
Yes. And the moment you ask yourself, why am I feeling this way?
Yeah.
Then that helps you to understand the process of comparison or the need for external validation or the need to fit in or the fact that I'm conditioned. You know, I grew up thinking this is right, and I meet someone who's different to me, and my mind is reacting in this way. I want to bully that person. Why am I feeling this way? But it begins, as you say, with awareness. So conditioning does this very powerful thing without our own awareness. It sets expectations from others in our own mind, which we then take for granted, that that's got to be the only thing. So if I don't pass that law exam or school with the top marks, I'm a nobody. I'm going to disappoint my parents. So many young people self-harm or take their own lives because they've disappointed somebody. And once you become aware of your own conditioning, not that it's wrong, but you're able to question it. And if you question it, you can set your own yardsticks. So I had this beautiful response from a 15-year-old. I gave a talk in a school. And at the end, she came up to me and she said, I loved your talk. I said, what was that? Why did you like it? She said, I thought I wasn't intelligent. But now I realize it's about the person that I am. It's not about my marks and grades and what other people think. And of course, in life, that's what's borne out, right? Your grades matter much less than you think they do. Let's move on and talk about challenging home circumstances. So we can't, obviously, not everyone comes from a loving home. There's a lack of love, parenting issues, financial challenges, sibling rivalry, all of those things. How can we equip young people with the tools to deal with that kind of adversity? Because that's growing around the world. You may not have had the most perfect childhood or growing up, and that can have a lifelong kind of negative impact on you. Any thoughts on that from anyone? Joe, any thoughts on that? Like, how do we empower young people to get past the adversity in their lives? Is it perhaps just by thinking, realizing this is short term and you are bigger than that or more powerful, or you have the skills in you to get past that?
I think that when kids are in the throes of this, that anything, of course, we never know. We could say the right thing, but my experience is that, and it doesn't mean that we don't try to say the right thing, but my experience is how we get them to sort of reframe life and teach them how to reframe life.
Love that, reframing life and maybe their thoughts and their feelings, just reframe things, right?
Right. They get stuck in one way, or they get stuck in their feeling. We know this. And when I have, my process is really does involve mind body with them a lot. When they can't identify what's really going on, I teach them to look to their body to inform them, and then to be able to put words to that. And then we can move into that experience of, can we change that sensation? And if we can change that sensation, then what does that tell us about how we can change how we feel about something and our ideas about something? And that's when I lead into the reframing.
Thank you. So, Samaira, go ahead.
I'd like to agree with Joe. It's an amazing, amazing thought of reframing. But I'd also like to say this, that once you're in that situation, and I'd like to say, I mean, whatever situation, I mean, as a teenager, I know that sometimes I'm not able to look past or ahead of that situation. So how do I reframe it? I'd like to ask you, Manoj, or anybody from the panel, I'd like to say that you guys are much more evolved than us and much more evolved than teenagers. What are your ways of reframing, and what ways do you feel that we can spread amongst teenagers in terms of reframing and thinking ahead of the situation, because it's very tough to stop your mind from always taking the worst case scenario and tackling it. It is possible, but not always.
Samaira, you said one thing that's absolutely not true, that adults are more evolved somehow than teenagers. I think it's the other way around. I think the teenagers some I've met are sometimes the smartest people ever. So one practical thing is use a journal. Use an online, we have an online journal. I'm going to show it to you in a second. But any journal, write down what you're thinking and feeling, and then ask yourself a question. Remember, your mind is going to assume what you think and what you feel is true. So when you write it down, the next question should be, how is it making me feel? Is there another way of looking at this? Is there another way? Is there a more positive way? Could an alternative way of looking at it be equally true? And what your question, Samaira, if this happened, would I be able to cope? Would I be okay? What would I do next? So there are many beautiful questions, and we have a whole set of guided questions on the app, which I'm going to show you in a minute. But I think guided questions, the questioning is the key. And what education isn't doing is helping young people ask questions about what they think and feel and believe. We're not teaching young people to question their own thinking. We're giving them stuff to think about, to put in their head. But you know, the root word of education, educere, is to draw out. It's not to stuff in. Everything we're going to teach them is on their phone. What we really need to teach them is how to think about thinking and feeling and so on. But Joe, go ahead. And then David, after that.
Yeah, I agree that guided questions are really helpful in terms of finding ways to shift your thinking. But I'll go back to something that I said before, Samaira, which is to go to your body, to really like feel what's going on in your body, get that sensation, because when you're in your head, it's all about cognition and it is hard to change those spinning thoughts. But if you go to your body and you develop a sense of mindfulness, which is another experience that is very helpful with this, then what you end up doing is you can see that the sensations that you're having that are that correspond to the thinking will change. That change gives you a sense that things don't have to remain the same, that your thoughts don't have to remain the same. And if it shifts, then you can shift your thinking. And that's what you're looking for, is that proof that, oh, things don't always stay the same, that change is always there.
Thank you, Joe. David.
You know, it's interesting. We're 52 minutes into the session and the word stigma has not been raised a single time. And it really surrounds so much of what we're talking about.
Yes.
And to Samaira's really excellent question, you know, how does one, I mean, we could do a whole nother hour on how one gets over stigma, but to me at its core, it's talking, right? It's talking about it. And so I agree with what Manaj said. We're not more evolved as adults, but what we do learn over time is, for most of us, if we're taking care of ourselves, is that our circle of friends starts to get smaller to focus on the individuals who care about us, who we care about, who we know we can trust. That's a harder one to do, as Joe commented on, when there's a time in our lives where we just need this connection. We kind of table at the law school every week where we just do something in the common space, put out literature and have giveaways or whatnot. And every year we do a word bubble session, and we invite our students in privacy, if they choose to take a word bubble, basically a literal, not literal, but if your classmates could see what you were thinking about over your head and write it down on a piece of paper. And then we put it up on a poster board for classmates to kind of walk by and see. And the point has been, if your peers could see what you were going through, they would realize, wow, that's me. Everybody, this stigma gets us all caught in our own head, like we're the only ones who are going through this, when in fact, all of us are going through some, you know, on the continuum, some mental health challenges, some issue. And so to me, at its core is finding space for people to trust each other at whatever age. Start small with the core people you really trust and have those conversations, and ideally be able to open it up. The mentorship, I think, is critical. I mean, if I were, you know, king for a day with unlimited resources, every high school, every junior high school would have the type of counselor, some of whom are here, with the resources and the support and the ability to do the outreach to the students that is so badly needed, because at the young age, it's the pipeline into, you know, everything else we're talking about.
Thank you. So speaking to that about stigma, if the statistics are correct and 27% of young people feel depressed, another statistic is that 70% of people with depression never seek help. And so you can see the amount of suffering that goes on in silence behind all the smiles that you see around. And so, David, to that point, that if we could open up those conversations and have those conversations with people we're close to. And I think that's one of the other things that we need to teach, is how to build intimacy. The art of relationship is not taught anywhere in education. And it's actually one of life's most critical and important skills. Okay. I'm going to take 2 minutes now and show you around the resources we've created in this app, which is all around self-inquiry and giving people the resources to help themselves. And then I'm going to come back and I want to ask each of you a question, which is, what can be done? What can we do to reduce the pressure on students, help them to understand their own mind, maybe change education? And what? How can we redefine the word success to also include being an excellent human being? So I'm just going to, so this is the app that we've got. It's called Happier Me, and it's downloadable. Yeah, you can, and it's also on your desktop. It's free to download, browse as a free trial, etc. And so it starts with a big section called Feel Better Now. And there's a lot of topics which you can relate to, but take stress, which is common. It starts with a simple breathing exercise, a 1 minute to a meditation, a couple of videos. And when you feel better, then it invites you to go deeper to understand what's, let's study the subject of stress. What's going on in my mind, as we were saying, as Gopalan said, when five people encounter the same situation, everyone reacts differently. Why is that? So the more you learn about stress, the better you are able to respond with your own intelligence. And as we know, stress impacts our mental and physical health, so it's absolutely critical. And though there are external causes of stress, as Janie was saying, there are many internal causes of stress. So there are 14 patterns of thinking that can help us live with much less stress if we understood them. And we've talked about some of them, like conditioning and comparison and so on. So that's the sort of Feel Better Now section. There's a daily practice, progress section. But here there are 8 topics you can explore in depth. Of course, as work and leadership for maybe older students like yours and David in college, mental health, relationships, how to be happy, deal with addiction. 1 in 6 young people has an addiction, or when I say young, I mean young adults, has an addiction to something. Deal with loss and manage your emotions. For young teenagers, managing your emotions becomes the number one thing. So for example, here we have a whole section on dealing with anger or the reactive mind or comparison. There's a big subject, big module on comparison, how the mind compares and how we can respond to that with our own intelligence. So if you take mental health, for example, there's detailed modules, there's life stories, guided questions, short videos, podcasts, past events, meditations and blogs. And I just want to show you the online journal. So for example, there's a question of the day. Every few screens, you're asked a question and your answers get stored in this journal. Like this is about self-image. But here is our list of guided questions. And each set of questions takes you from where you are to a better place, hopefully. So for example, if you want to be happier, you begin here. And why do you want to be happy? All the way down to, you know, what's getting in the way of being happy now? Are you caught up in negative thoughts? How real are they? And so on. There's also a forum where you can ask a question, but we have some coaches on the platform that you can ask a question to anonymously. So that's a really great resource that a lot of people are using. So that's that. And this is a quick answer section. So suppose you come in here and you're feeling lonely. There's a quick answer, like we feel lonely because we're not connected with others. And then it leads you to the module on loneliness, where you can explore the subject in greater depth. So that's the, and for people who don't have a problem right now, but want to develop as human beings to be the best version of themselves, we have a program called Pathway. By the way, the entire app is based on looking and learning about yourself, not on a religious philosophy or a book. So it begins with exercises for a calm mind, then the art of inquiry, including you were saying, Joe, how to be with a feeling, how to look without language. It's such a beautiful skill to learn how to ask the right questions. The three steps to inquiry I spoke about earlier. Understand how your mind works. We've talked about some of these today, conditioning and comparison, our emotional needs, which we haven't mentioned. And then how to manage your emotions. There's a big module, for example, on depression and how to manage it yourself if you don't want to talk to somebody. Of course, ideally, you want to talk to people, but if you don't, then how do you do that? And then how do you apply this understanding of your own mind to flourish in life, whether it's in your relationships or deal with criticism or avoid addiction or avoid obesity or an eating disorder or deal with bullying? And all the way to, hey, how can we be more kind? Because one of the common things I see all the time in young people is this lack of kindness. There are many other resources. There are podcasts, videos. I'll leave you to explore this for yourself. And for those who want to begin their journey of self-awareness and inquiry and don't know what to do about it, where to begin, these exercises are beautiful. They've been created in conjunction with educators. For example, notice your thoughts. It's a 9-day challenge. So you learn one new thing every day. So on day three, you learn your mind is reactive. Or on day four, you learn we assume what we think is true. Or on day six, we'll learn our mind judges all the time, and so on. And this learning is what brings transformation. So I'm going to pause that there and open this up to a discussion. So Janie, may I start with you? What do you think we could do? What do we need to change in education then to support young people to help them manage their own mental health?
Well, I think we could make changes to the whole facilitation style, the way that that children are being taught, in that teachers learning more about coaching and asking questions and that sort of idea of mentoring, I really, really like. And I think the curriculum to just open out the curriculum and allow more space within the curriculum for self-understanding. I teach the teenagers that I teach them about their brain and about the fact that it's undergoing a big renovation, they're in primitive survival mode, they really do need to fit in, they're separating from their family, and they're needing to form other social attachments, and how important that is, but also how the brain has written its own script. And so I love the idea of the reframing, but it's almost helping young people, particularly if they come from a certain background that you're talking about, how do I rewrite my script? So how do I start to think, okay, so that was me, but how am I going to move forward so that discussions about not being rooted in the problem and in the past, but facilitated discussions about how would I like things to be in the future. So very solution focused space, a lot about understanding relationships and communication, but it's all done in a style that's being role modeled to them. So they're learning by through the mode of teaching.
Jenny, thank you. How do we, do you think there's some appetite for schools to bring self-understanding into education? Because it's been, it's my passion, it's yours. What do
I
educators?
think there is. No, I think there definitely is. I mean, I think we need more, you know, certainly in this country, we need more emphasis on PSHE being statutory, and that it is absolutely has to be part of the curriculum. And then that when we look at the actual curriculum, that it isn't done in a very sort of boring and sort of didactic way, that it's done in a way that young people are genuinely really interested. They're not thinking, oh, it's PSHE, I can sort of sleep at the back. It's not. It's like circle time. It's about real understanding. We bring real dilemmas to the class. So, you know, people can talk about these things. What do we already know about this problem? And starting it from that point, as opposed to teachers doing a sort of tick box on all those things. There's all that social emotional learning about different cultures and different, you know, that there's so much that we've got to equip young people for, to be ready for the world when they leave school.
Yes, thank you, Samaira. You and I have been traveling, and we've been exploring self-awareness, self-understanding, the Happier Me app, and so on. What are your thoughts on all this?
I'd say, I'm in 12th grade, I'm giving my boards. And in these 12 years of studying through different schools, since my dad's serving in the armed forces, I've never seen, you know, group discussions on mental health, and maybe once, but it was a very brief conversation. There was no opening up. There was no, stimulation for the mind to understand what we're talking about in sixth grade. There was no real conversation, as Janie is saying, that we need to get real dilemmas. I remember you were making me do this activity where I had to review experiences of people. And I cannot explain the empathy I had for them, because I'm looking at real life problems, real life dilemmas, and I could come up with some situations on how to help them. I feel the school should do the same. I feel journaling is an amazing, amazing activity. I personally practice yoga, reframing again, and the idea of identification and tackling should be definitely taught in schools. This is a very big concept, and I've never seen schools really do this. They should definitely include this in their curriculum. And there's so many reasons of stress and anxiety and depression. Tackling each of them would be very difficult for the school, of course, but major sections like I've never seen schools in India talking about sexual education, sex education. I've never seen schools in India talk about, it's kind of a, how do you say it? The schoolless economy in children that the kids have, the schoolless economy. We need to break that and really talk about it. And the schools and educators need to inculcate some practices on a regular basis. That's how I think we can come ahead.
Thank you, Samaira. Thank you. It's so nice and wonderful to hear young people articulate this. And, I think your voices are so much more important and carry weight. Gopalan, any reflections on what we can do to help young people? And
I think it lies in the questions we ask.
Yes.
Because we are clearly expressing that it is possible to introduce, like what Janice said, that the system is open to discuss things like understanding yourself and why are we responding in this way, and but what is really stopping us from doing this? Why is the system resisting? If everybody says that we need to do this, because it's so subject-oriented for so long, and we leave out the most important component, which is dealing with another human being.
Yes.
And understanding, isn't it?
And yourself.
Dealing with another human being. In order to do that, you must also know that there is a human being that is dealing with another human being.
Yes, the art of relationship.
Yeah.
David, before he left, said his suggestion was to ban cell phones in schools and embed 30 minutes of quiet time for journaling or meditation or mindfulness. Joe, have you got any thoughts on what we could do? You've worked with young people, well, for all your life.
I think all of these suggestions are really important ones. I think that they all get down to time and the allowance of time and the allowance of silence. If you take kids' cell phones away, and we're experimenting that with that here in many of our schools, there are now greater restrictions, at least through the eighth grade, with students that they cannot have their phones in the classroom. And they can only use them on free periods or at lunchtime. And sometimes that's really necessary because of the way they need to connect with their parents outside of school. But of course, it leads to other things too. But I think it's about time. And what I have seen, and especially having been at the upper realm of this as an administrator, with more and more standards coming down from on high, curriculum-wise, time is a real commodity. Teachers are overwhelmed. We talked about this a little while ago about, you had mentioned, I think, teacher stress. Teachers are really having a very hard time accomplishing the curriculum. Every minute counts. And so how do we clear that time for these very important things? We can't even get families to do that.
Yes, Joe, thank you. So I think one of the things I really think is important is to reduce the curriculum. Because I've seen our 16-year-old stepson and what he's got four maths exams, three geography exams at 16, three history exams. I mean, everything he's learning is on his phone and he's going to forget it the moment he gets out of that exam. Even the teachers who are teaching history, you catch them on a bad day, say, what do you tell me the 10 eight wives of Henry VIII. They don't know the answer. They've got to look it up. So why should we expect young people to remember all this stuff? It would take so much pressure off if educators did that. And we redefine the word success, not just to mean money and wealth and fame and all of that, but also to say it's about kindness. It's about being an excellent human being who's at peace with themselves and others, lives with compassion, goodness, all of those things. But it needs to begin with parents, teachers, schools, society. The whole ecosystem around kids needs to start saying success is about. Because in the end, if you ask young people, why do you want to be wealthy and happy, wealthy and famous and all that, they say it's about being happy. I said, why aren't you happy now? And they said, happiness is hard. I said, well, maybe that's what we need to teach them. Samaira, you had your hand up. Go ahead.
I would actually like to go back to the concept of spending time alone. So I recently read this article where there was this survey conducted where people, teenagers rather, were given an option to spend time alone for 15 minutes without their phones. And if they couldn't do that, they would have to go through an electric shock. And an alarming number of students opted for the electric shock. And this is just so alarming to me. And this needs to change. We have this, on iPhones and I think other phones, we have the settings and we can see how many times have we picked up our phone. If it's more than 200, and which I see a lot of people have it more than 200 times, it is pure addiction. So we definitely do need to spend more time alone with ourselves. And this is a great idea of spending time alone for 30 minutes with our own thoughts. Are we, I mean, I've heard a lot of my friends saying that we are scared of spending alone time with our thoughts, which needs to change.
Thank you, Samaira. So Dr. Monica has asked, can we add some points about the importance of mindfulness training and assertive training and so on? So on the app, we've got a whole section on breathing exercises, mindfulness, etc. So there are many resources out there. But the key thing, as Samaira said, is to be able to use them and take away. The reason we become addicted to the phone is because of the way our mind is wired. Because our mind is wired to seek pleasure, wired to seek being occupied, and we are uncomfortable being alone in our own company, in our own thoughts. And we're frightened of something we're not used to. That's why we're And for young people, it's sometimes 10 hours a day on the phone, you know? That's become the new modern addiction. So, okay. All right, we're just going to start winding up now. Yes, Gopalan, please go ahead.
We're not only afraid of our own, I mean, being alone on our own and just sitting there. We are equally uncomfortable sitting with someone and not doing anything. We just need to do something with that. I mean, to engage with that person instead of just. That's why when in conversations we feel awkward when there's a long silence.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for that. Any other comments before we wind up for the day? Okay. Well, thank you very much to all my guests from around the world who've joined us today. We've had a really rich discussion. By no means we've exhausted it. We didn't end up talking about fear, for example. But the Happier Me app has all these resources. Please download it, have a look. It's free to download and browse. And I will send a recording of this to everyone. So thank you again and have a wonderful weekend.